Okay, why don't we get started? Welcome everyone to this session early in the morning. Brave soul coming here early, this is great. Hopefully it will be interesting. So my name is Tobias Ternström, and I'm a program manager in the SQL product group, and work primarily on performance in Azure SQL Database.
Morning, folks. My name is Sasha Nosov. I am also a program manager in the data platform group. And my responsibility is the business continuity and disaster recovery stack in Azure SQL Database. So the agenda today is cover these two topics. We kind of split the session to talk about the performance we're introducing with the new service tiers. And I will spend the second half talking about business continuity and disaster recovery, and we'll show a few demos. So with that, I will give it to Bias, and he'll take off.
Okay, cool. And please, if you have questions, please just ask them and wave and whatnot during the talk, because we'll both be all confused if you push all of the questions to the end and ask about something that's completely out of context. So feel free to ask, and if one of you are wondering something, then probably someone else has questions as well. And I have a rule, so no hard questions, only kind of low balls. And I'm from Sweden, so irony is the only kind of humor we have. So let's talk a bit about performance in Azure SQL Database. So how many of you guys are using or have tried or evaluating Azure SQL Database today? Roughly half, maybe two-thirds? Okay. It's good. So what I'm going to talk about is basically these topics. So one is there is a case for change. So how many of you guys have seen that we announced new service tiers and a bunch of new functionality last month? Okay, some of you. For some of you, this will be new then. And we'll talk about some concepts related to this. The actual new service tiers, and then some models of how we see customers using it, both from very small companies and startups up to very, very large installations and enterprises. So first of all, on this case for change. So today we have these web and business edition databases, or types of databases, and we've introduced premium in July last year, and then we've added to this stack basic and standard edition on April 24th last month. And the main reason for this is we've had a huge amount of customer feedback since more or less early on when Azure SQL Database went live, and it was called SQL Azure, on please, can I somehow get predictable performance? And obviously, also, we have a bunch of feature requests coming in, which Sasha will talk more about. And the issue we had with web and business is so, first of all, just to set context, SQL Azure back in the day was very early as a database as a service. And it was decided we need a simple business model, right? So, cloud and especially PaaS is about simplicity. We need to make it easy so that you can focus on building your applications. So the business model that was chosen was you pay per storage, you pay per gigabyte of database size. And that works from being simple. It's easy to understand. I have a 2 gig database, I pay $10. I have a, or whatever it is, $20, and 1 gig database is $10, and 100 was $5, and so on. But there was no ability for you to say, hey, I would like a certain amount of performance. So just because you have, for example, a 150 gig database doesn't necessarily mean that you need a lot of hardware resources to run your queries. And just because your database happens to be half a gig doesn't mean that you don't need it. So this was our journey started to basically allow customers to pay for what they value. In premium in July. So we introduced this price for performance instead, where you could buy a P1 or a P2 with a certain amount of throughput and hardware resources. So in web and business today, you pay for storage. There is really no no guarantees or no objectives that the system has around providing you a certain level of performance. We put enough databases on a node so that we can guarantee the availability, meaning that you can connect and that we don't lose your data, and we keep the data replicated between 3 or 4 other nodes in different fault zones in our data centers. And then the system basically has this throttling mechanism that I'm sure a bunch of you have run into, where the system goes, ooh, there's a little bit too much going on here. Ah, that guy seems to be abusing the system a bit too much, and it's causing harm, and we could potentially lose availability because of this, because of the system, for example, not keeping up with things. So let's stop this database from running its workload. So you kind of recycle that database, and you can get back in after a while, and your connections get shut down and so on. And this, the system does this from a just protection standpoint. And the performance varies greatly. So you can have more or less excellent performance in web and business because you happen to be on a machine, or your primary happen to be on a machine that's just not very busy right now. Or you happen to be on a machine where there is lots of things going on, and your performance degrades as a result of this. It also depends a little bit on which region you're in and so on, how busy that region is. And instead, in premium and now in basic and standard, we have priced the tiers based on a combination of performance and features. So you basically pay for the amount of performance you need and for the business continuity features you need. Instead of doing throttling, throttling could still happen, but it would be extremely, extremely rare. We govern the amount of resources that's given to a database. So we'll say, hey, you get this amount of resources, and off you go, and those resources should be as close to guaranteed as possible. So this gives us a very, very predictable performance, meaning that you can bet that if you have good performance today, you'll have good performance tomorrow. And this is in preview again and since April, so you can go out and use it today. We have a minor glitch in the system today, which means you have to create a new logical server in Azure SQL Database and say that that logical server, I would like to support the new editions. There's a preview thing you have to sign into first. You can find it on the Azure homepage. Once you get into the preview, you create a new logical server, and there you can create databases of these new tiers. I think beginning of June, this will go away, and you'll be able to switch from web and business to the new service tiers in existing logical servers. So that should make it very easy to kind of try out the new tiers. And it's backwards compatible with web and business editions. So there's two caveats to this. One is we have deprecated federations, and we'll remove that as part of removing web and business editions in 1 year from now, basically April next year. So let's have a look at some concepts that we've introduced. So DTU as well as Azure SQL Database Benchmark. So first of all, we needed a measure of how much performance do you need, and we wanted this to be easy to understand and not be polluted by a lot of caveats. You have to read kind of a white paper of 15 pages to figure out what was actually going on. And also, we needed something that we could maintain across hardware versions as we kind of upgrade the data centers. So we introduced this concept of a database throughput unit, which you can think about as just the amount of resources assigned to your database in a kind of constant manner. So if you have one DTU, you always have that amount of hardware resources that one DTU represents. And this basically gives you a bounding box around your database resources. So you cannot get more resources than what the bounding box allows, right? So if you have one DTU worth of resources, you cannot get 1.5. But also, it allows us to actually give you this amount of resources with predictability so that you don't have this stochastic performance where one day it's great and the next day it's not good, and where you could actually bet on it. It's a blended measure, so it includes things like CPU memory reads and writes, read from disk, write to transaction log on disk. And obviously, your workload may not need
like 100% of each of the bounding boxes. Typically, memory, you will go to 100% if your database isn't very small. But the other resources, you may not need to. So if you look at the left chart here, you can see how an example workload, this workload, for example, seems to run into 100% on CPU and use maybe 50, 60% of writes and only a little bit of reads and 60% of the memory. And we show you how much is being used. So you can go into the portal and see what percentage across these four dimensions are you actually using right now. So instead of trying to figure out things like IOPS, a core of some version at some point in time, you just look at the percentages. And if you're in, these percentages relate to the offer you're in. So if you're in an offer that has one DTU and you're at 100%, and then you move to an offer that has five DTUs, then if you didn't need more than 100%, you would be at roughly 20% in the new offer. So it makes it easy for you to kind of see if you need to upgrade or downgrade over time, and also compare the performance across the different tiers. And yeah, like I mentioned, so simplifies talking about performance, so trying to understand IOPS versus percent. Because IOPS has so much to do with what the software actually decides to do. For example, our IO operations may be between 8 kilobytes and a couple of megabytes in size. And if I then tell you I did 15 IOPS, it's not really meaningful. So Azure SQL Database Benchmark, this is the second thing we introduced, and this is to help you understand how an example workload may run against the offer you select. So again, a benchmark is just an example. We picked something that we think is representative of an OLTP type application, and we ran it in a controlled environment against each of the offers in the public environment, so to see what actual throughput you would get out of it. And we've also we have a link to a lot more information about the benchmark. We've also separated how we look at the figures. So for the lower tiers, you look at number of transactions per a longer interval of time versus a higher tier where you look at over a shorter period of time. So the thinking is, if you need a $5 database, and you, for example, have, an app that handles point of sale system for a single store, right? You're not thinking about how many transactions you actually need per second. Well, I don't know. I don't do things by the second. So that's why we show for example, the basic tier. We say, well, you get 3,000 something transactions per hour of this example benchmark. So you can get a sense of, okay, well, how many loaves of bread do I sell over an hour? Oh, it's 10. Okay, so this may work for me, right? In the standard tier, we say transactions per minute, and in the premium tier, we say transactions per second. And again, this is just an example workload to kind of help people self-select. But there's no limit on number of transactions. If you do very, very tiny, simple transactions, you could probably get hundreds of thousands of transactions through the basic tier. So these are the new service tiers with some more details, and on the performance side, and then Sasha will fill in on the business continuity side. So the number of DTUs in the basic tier is one, and in standard we have two performance levels, S1 and S2, where one is five DTUs, meaning roughly five times the performance of basic, and one is 25, meaning roughly 25 times the performance of basic or the resources of basic. And in premium, you have 100 up to 800 DTUs. And there you can see the results of the benchmark. So running the benchmark, this is the average number of transactions you could get through the benchmark. And it's kind of similar to if you think about TPCC or something like this. We get lots of questions, why don't we just publish TPCC numbers here? And there is a bunch of reasons. One is kind of related to how well it works in cloud. It's about TPC has rules related to what you can do with the benchmark and not. And specifically, you have to publish all of the hardware details that you run the benchmark on. So this is one of the reasons that none of the cloud vendors basically show the TPC numbers. Because for one is you never have just one hardware generation running. Then the maximum database size, as you can see, in basic it's limited to 2 gigabytes. In standard, we have increased from web and business 150 gigs to 250 gigs, and the max size in premium is 500 gigabytes. And here you can see how the price changes across the tiers. And it's important to note that we prorate price daily. So if you run a database, you can move it, you can be in basic for 15 days, move it to a P3 for 1 day, and go in S1 for the rest of the days, for example. And then you would pay exactly for the number of days that you were in a specific tier. If you're in a tier for just a few hours, you pay for the basically high watermark of tier that you were in for the day. So if you're in P3 for 5 minutes for 1 day, you still pay for P3. So changing the performance level, this is important to note that this is a fully online operation. And we allow you to do it through the portal as well as through a bunch of different APIs. So for those of you who like automating things in PowerShell, you can use PowerShell. We have PowerShell commandlets where you can basically list and get properties related to SQL Azure or Azure SQL DB, as well as set and change properties. You have a REST interface. We have a .NET managed wrapper that's currently in preview. So if you have NuGet installed in Visual Studio, there is a NuGet. You search for Azure SQL Database and pre-release, and you'll find the .NET managed wrapper around the REST interface. And in T-SQL, currently we expose only changing the edition, meaning the service tiers. You can go from basic to standard to premium, which means basic S1, P1. And we will expose also the ability to change the performance level through T-SQL. And again, when you do it, your application continues to run. And then at some point, you switch into the new service tier. And we have both the APIs as well as dynamic management views that you can query to see, hey, how is this going? Is it done yet? And it can take anywhere between just a few seconds to a couple of hours, depending on which tier your change is between and what we need to do with the change. So sometimes we basically have to move your replicas to another set of machines. And that can take, that's the size of data operations, so it can take some time. And I think you're limited to 4 changes per day. Yep. Good question. So the question is there some notification I can get when it's done? No, unfortunately not. It requires polling. So you will have to ask, am I done or not? Let me quickly just show you this in the portal to just set context for you folks who haven't used this. So I'm here in the Azure SQL or Azure portal on SQL database, and I have a bunch of databases here. And I can just click on my P1. And here we have the scale tab. And I can go here, and here you can see I've chosen the edition or service tier premium. And here I can select between the different service levels. And when I click, we basically start moving you to that new service tier. The max size, we don't charge you for storage. So if you have 1 megabyte in your P1 database, or if you have 500 gigabytes, it's the same price. So the max size is mostly there because we had it before, and it allows you, if you're, for example, an ISV and you yourself put restrictions on what your customers can do, you can use the max size to limit the database size. So what about performance monitoring? And first of all, I'll just apologize. We need to get better here, and we're working hard on making this a lot better. So what we have right now is you can see how much these percentages, how much you're using, and you see a picture here, both through the Azure portal as well as this catalog viewer, DMV, in the master database called resource stats or sys.resource stats. So you can query this and basically see the percentage of reads, writes, and CPU that you're using. We don't have memory there yet, unfortunately. It's coming. And why I'm saying we have work to do here is because this is currently 5-minute averages, right? So that means, for example, if you had a spike and ran at 100% for 2.5 minutes and then did nothing for 2.5 minutes, you would see 50%. through the SysResource stats and in the portal. So that's an important thing to note. And we know we need to improve here, so that's a high priority for us to get you things like real-time data where you can look at, like in Perfmon, what's going on right now, see things like maxes and so on over time. But SysResource stats is still valuable. So even if it's averages, you can now see what's been happening over time and run queries against it and see, well, hey, what's the max 5-minute average that I had per day? What's the average over the day and so on to figure out which service tier should you be on. And through the portal and through APIs, you can also set up alerts on this and say, hey, alert me if the average goes to, for example, 80% for CPU. And then, just as an FYI, we still have a bunch of query tuning related DMVs, and that's also something we're working on adding more to Azure SQL DB. So you have DMX query stats, for example, where you can see statistics for each of the queries that currently reside in the procedure cache, how much CPU they've been using, how many times they've been executed, things like this. So these are super valuable as you optimize your app. So app optimization is obviously still super important, right? If you make your app more efficient, you can run it in a lower tier, and basically you can run your app at a lower cost. And these DMVs are excellent help to find out what to optimize. And they behave the same as they would in SQL Server. So DMX query SQL text is just getting the SQL text of a query from query stats. Query plan, same thing, just get the query plan. You can save it to a file, open it in Management Studio, you'll see the graphical execution plan. And exec requests, see what requests are currently going on. And we have a limit on the number of concurrent requests that you can have. So the number of worker threads that we allow. And these are documented in the Azure site. So this is where you would go to figure out if you have issues, why do I have so many requests going on? And it's important to note that just increasing the number of requests doesn't really help the system. If your app needs a certain throughput, it will try to push. So if you run into the worker threads, typically you either need to optimize your app or move to a larger service tier, which will have more worker threads, but primarily will have more resources to run your requests faster so that you don't need as many requests concurrently. And then DMX sessions is just number of sessions that you have connected to your database. Okay, so let's take a quick look here at just the performance between the editions. First off, I just wanted to show you, because we somehow managed to hide these interesting counters that I mentioned in the portal. So I'm in my database, I click on monitor, and you see by default we show deadlocks, failed connections, and successful connections. And so basically you have to go to add metric and then say, hey, I would like to see also CPU percentage, let me remove these, log write percentage, and physical data reads percentage. And then you have to check these little round things. That took me a while. So here we can see that apparently I've been up to about 1% of CPU on average for this database when I've been playing around. So let's just take a quick look at performance. Now this is an example of a kind of CPU intensive query, just as a simple thing. So I'm in S1, and a database called S1. It is in fact an S1. I run set statistics time on just so that we provide you the statistics around time of execution and compilation and things like this. And I run this query. Why this query is interesting is because I query these different tables. I think they each have 20 rows. And then I do a count distinct of concatenating these. There should be four grids. Anyway, the three grids here. And that basically kind of removes the possibility for any sneaky optimizations. I will basically have to do the actual count of these grids. So started the query. This is perfect if you don't have that much content. There we go, came back, and it took about 18 seconds. So 18,195 milliseconds to execute on the S1. And if I go to, which is with 5 DTUs, if I go to my S2 with 25 DTUs, it came back in roughly just under 4 seconds, so 3,801 milliseconds. And if I go to my P1, run the same query, basically comes back immediately, so 1.2 or 3 seconds. And again, this could have been one database, and I could have moved between the tiers, but it would have taken me some time to do the move between them. But again, the move operation is online, so it's not like with a VM you have to shut it down or anything like that. You just call the API or do it through the portal, and it moves between the tiers. And the important thing here to note is if you kept running this, you should get very, very consistent response times, as long as you don't change anything in the app, or your app does a lot of things at the same time. So with the same load, you should get very, very reliable performance. So finally, some notes around what we see out in the world, what our customers are doing, and what seems to work well, and so on. So this is kind of if you simplify things, the 4 common patterns that we see. And all of them are absolutely valid. So first of all, the first one is kind of the common simple example, right? The common simple one, which is the most common. That's the most we see, obviously, is I have one database, right? My Fabricam database, and it has my invoices, customers, and so on. Vertically partitioned, we see also quite a bit where I have one invoice database, I have one order, one inventory, so some type of vertical partitioning. And then what we see a lot of for the larger installations is the single tenant per DB, as well as the other partition, some other partitioning scheme where you basically go to N databases. You do some sort of scale out theme or scheme in order to be able to basically get to any amount of load on the system. So we have gotten some questions asking, hey, now that you have these performance levels, are you all about scale up now? And no, that's absolutely not the case. So P3, the max that we allow, is still running on one machine plus all of the other machines for high availability. So you can get to a fairly high throughput, but there is definitely a ceiling. And if you need to go above the ceiling, you need to scale out. So all our large installations, all our large customers, and also startups that basically expect a lot of load, you should definitely design your app to scale out. It's somewhat unfortunate that we've deprecated federations. So again, it's not removed. If you're using it, it works. And we haven't announced a replacement yet. But you should definitely know that we are all into using SQL DB to scale out. We think it's super, super important. And there's a bunch of use cases and patterns and sample code out there. And there's, in fact, another session by Scott Klein later today covering scale out patterns on SQL DB. So we definitely believe in that, and you should definitely not step back from this. In fact, what happens with the new tiers is you can do a lot more, right? So obviously I can scale up my single DB and run it at a P3, for example. But I can also scale up different partitions, right, within my scale-out architecture. So a very common pattern is that you have some sort of root database that knows about the other database, some type of list partitioning. And that guy often gets a lot of requests. So it's fairly common to have the root database be some sort of premium, while most of the leaves may even be basic. But now you have the ability to say, hey, this leaf is now hot. Let's make this leaf a P2 or an S2 or something like that. And you can do that as an online operation. So it's important to note that these things work very well together and, in fact, complement one another quite a lot. So what we see a lot is software as a service vendors. And basically, the most common pattern is this. So you have one set of code, right, that runs over N websites or VMs that talk to N databases. And a lot of them do actually one database per tenant. And the interesting thing with this pattern is you can basically sell on to your customers or sell through to your customers features in Azure SQL DB, such as restore, right? So point-in-time restore, Sasha will talk about. And if I want to do a point-in-time restore, if I have many customers in the same database, I would have to point-in-time restore all of them and somehow fetch the one I'm interested in and push it into the right database. Whereas if I do single tenant per database, I could just go and restore that particular one. Or if one of the customers requires some sort of geo-replication, you can do it now for that particular customer versus doing it across the board. And obviously you can combine, which we also see. So customers, for example, may use this model for their paying customers, their paying tier. And if they have a free tier, they may have a couple of databases where basically the customers share database with other tenants. And yeah, central metadata database. That's the root thing I talked about. And so basically what you would see in this code, you know, if you come in, you first check the cache, right? The cache is super important here. You say, hey, do I know where this particular tenant is? If I don't know in cache, I go and check the directory and ask, hey, where is this guy? Oh, it's over in, you know, the West data center in Europe, this particular database. And I then go and connect to that database and run the query there. It's important to think about, if you want to make this efficient, this caching business is super important so that you can go directly to the database. And then you need some way to invalidate that charge. So if you have done some sort of multiple customers per database scheme or even restore or something like this, this database may no longer be the right one just because your app has decided to move the data somewhere else. So then if you go check the cache and then go directly to step three down there, step two and three, you would check somehow to see, is this still the right place to be, right? So the local database would know if it's the master for this particular partition that you're looking for. And this is just an example of this charted model that is pretty obvious. So you could have multiple databases basically in the same, or multiple logical databases in the same physical logical databases, complicated. And then you would have some sort of partitioning key that's spread across your tables so you know which tenant this is. And then you obviously have to make sure you have the right predicates as you query and say, well, it's always and tenant ID equals something across all of the tables. Okay, so let's move to business continuity and Sasha.
All right, folks. So as Tobias mentioned and sort of set this up for me already, we are changing to essentially charging customers for performance. We define the entire business model based on that consideration. However, we also differentiate based on features. So as you move from lower service tiers to higher service tiers, you will see sort of an increased surface area, if you will. And business continuity is one of the differentiators. In fact, today it's the kind of the main one. But later on, we will also introduce additional features we will see being used as differentiators. So what I'd like to do is I basically want to define the problem first. I want to talk about how we approach the solution. And then we'll also talk about different patterns of sort of doing the disaster recovery. First of all, business continuity is not just about major failures. Sometimes kind of that is the common opinion, but we are thinking about it is as the ability of the application to operate in spite of variety of sort of disruptive events, planned and unplanned. And sort of those could be from failures of individual nodes, routers inside of our data centers, maybe some data corruptions because of some bugs or whatever. That is sort of typical on-premise, in the cloud, everywhere. We deal with that. Interesting thing about it, while this happens very infrequently on individual servers, given the sheer number of the nodes we have in the cloud, this is essentially a daily occurrence. So there's absolutely no way this is something that the customers could be involved in fixing. So this needs to be done automatically without you being exposed to it. The second problem is, you know, people errors, code bugs, accidental data corruptions because of mistakes. This is essentially what typically is the backups and restores are used for. Interesting thing about that scenario is we cannot detect it. We have no knowledge whether you're using the right security credentials or you really want to delete this table or you really want to change this value in this particular column. This is something only the application knows. So an important observation here is that the owners of the servers built on top of Azure Database must take actions here. Now, of course, we have to also think about major disaster, and it is also, unfortunately, a fact of life. We have major events, acts of God, malicious actions of people, something that can take down the entire infrastructure in the region. So geographic disaster is obviously, it is very infrequent, but the cost of it and the impact of it is tremendous. So those are what I call unplanned events, something that you just sort of, you know they will happen, but you never know when. And finally, there are a set of scenarios around changes that must happen. For example, in your application that you deploy in the cloud. But those changes also introduce risks and certain level of potential disruption. And we call them planned events. And a good example of such an event is, for example, an application update. You are releasing a new version. It involves a new schema. You have to move your database to that new schema. Maybe you're adding some additional data to the database. That process might take some time, and it also might fail because, again, of the human errors or what have you. So this is a potential disruption. But the interesting thing in the cloud, more and more, the services just cannot afford being down for that sort of maintenance. They still have to continue to operate the business and yet perform the upgrades and other things similar to it. So the workflows that you start, you know when it happens, but still you want to protect in case this fails. So that is kind of the range of business continuity scenarios. So if you already been operating, I've seen a few, I think about 35%, 75% maybe already familiar. Maybe you already read about this or attended some of the sessions, so we introduced that before. But the idea basically, in order for us to protect from these blue screen things, we have redundancy inside data centers. Every database has up to 4 additional copies being constantly synchronized. And what happens when you operate, you are exposed to essentially a logical database. It's an abstraction that looks like a database, but in reality, it has a primary and several secondaries behind it. Every time you do a read, we just basically connect you to the primary, immediately respond, and you get the results. When you do a write, what we basically commit the transaction on the primary and start committing transaction on the secondaries as well, and we wait for at least one other secondary to act before the transaction is returned so that we know for sure if any of those nodes fail, we have at least one other node that has the data that is synchronized. And of course, the rest will be synchronized sort of in this a lazy function. So we only kind of block on one of the acts, but not all of the acts, again, to make sure that the performance is good. So this is how we actually get to an uptime of 9995. That is our target. It's in preview now, so we do not guarantee that sort of uptime. But once we go GA, general availability, that is the number that you will get with the new service tiers. So that system of what we call high availability platform allows us to guarantee that level of uptime. The next one is, remember, the second scenario is about human error. So what happens is those nodes that I mentioned before, they have backups, each of them individually. So we have high redundancy of the backups, and we take those backups using certain sort of schedule. Once a week, we take a full backup of the database. Once a day, we take a differential backup. And every 5 minutes, we copy transaction logs. So we have the entire history of data changes on every node. In addition, we put the backups daily and weekly into the storage in the cloud. So essentially, you have not only the redundancy inside of the data center, you also have the same redundant backups geo-replicated to a different location as well. So there is a lot of data to be kind of to be counting on in case something happens. So if you need to rectify an error, some accidental data change, we allow you to essentially execute a restore. You don't have to worry about backups. It's taken care of automatically. But you can essentially call an API or go to portal and say, hey, I made a mistake. Please restore a version of my database at that time. And we will start a process of restoring, and you will see the results of it. And the time it takes to restore is really a function of your size of the database as well as the size of the log. Of course, if you have a lot of transactions and the log is extremely, there is a lot of sort of a lot of activity going on. So what happens, we have to play forward all those transactions to a point in time you selected. So of course, the more database is active, the more time it takes for us to play forward. But essentially, it's something that you know about. You control that to an extent. So it's self-service. You can choose either REST API. You can use PowerShell. You can go to portal to request. And it always creates a database side by side. For example, you operate your primary database for your business. It's not going to be impacted by this. Let's say you've lost an important customer order. You keep on doing whatever it is doing. You restore the database side by side, online, without impacting that operation, and you can then dump that customer order to, or insert that order into the live database as you will. So you can basically just sort of explore the restored database one case. Of course, if you've deleted the database, then there is nothing left. So you have to basically just restore and get what you get. But that's kind of most extreme example. Now we have we are differentiating between the service tiers for backup and restore as well. And our criteria is retention. So currently, in basic, we have 1 day and only one backup. Essentially, we use only full backup and daily backup to restore. We don't allow you to have this granular setting. This is actually going to change soon, but for now, this is what it is. In standard, we allow you to go back to 7 days. And in premium, actually, this is incorrect. It's a typo. It's a 35 days retention policy. So you have 35 days to go back to in case you realize, OK, last month, I have this information in the database, and it's gone. How do I get it? You can go back and restore. And finally, the sort of the scenario around geographic disasters. If you go back to that first slide I showed where I was talking about the replication within the data center, an important observation there is that we know how to replicate, we know how to synchronize, we have all the necessary sort of building blocks, except we are using essentially a local network for it with a very low latency, which is why we can make it automatic. You don't have to, you know, worry about data sort of being behind in the secondary, et cetera. So what we've done is we've extended that platform, essentially, to replicate across regions. But now we have to be mindful that there is latency involved. And the latency depends on proximity. So if you're talking about, let's say, within the US, it could be 40 milliseconds. If you're talking about between US and Europe, it could be, you know, 250 milliseconds, et cetera. So this is a fact of life, kind of laws of physics. So nothing we can do about it, which is why we cannot really be synchronous. Because if we are synchronous and we are waiting for an egg, that will impact the performance of the primary. So we have to deal with this sort of challenge here. And it's interesting that some applications are much more resilient to data loss than others. At the same time, some applications can wait, for example, longer to see if the primary location is restored than others. Some application might say, you know what, I'd rather take the data loss and move on and be up, you know, immediately or as quickly as possible, even though I recognize I might have lost some number of transactions that have been committed already to the primary. So in order for us to kind of reconcile those two extremes, we decided that we need to give control to the application. We decided that it's only the app itself knows what it needs to optimize for, whether it's sort of data preservation as a kind of the must and most important thing, or the uptime in case of these geographic disasters. So what we have is essentially the ability to control which database you want to create a redundant copy of, where you want to create the redundant copy of, and how many copies you would like to have. So essentially, this is very, very flexible interface that enables essentially a variety of scenarios. And I will talk about the additional scenarios it enables later on. But this is basically the most kind of the flexible mechanism available to only premium service tier. And the rationale behind behind making that available only for premium is because we believe premium represents sort of the business critical part of the customer base. The databases that are super important, super critical, and we make an assumption that the availability and ability to recover fast for those databases is super important. So that's the mechanism we enable, and sort of the way it happens is that replication starts immediately. It doesn't wait. You commit a transaction. We don't block on it, but it uses a pipeline, and the transaction is communicated immediately. So the data loss that you actually incur in most cases will be probably seconds, not more. So when you fail over, the RPO, real RPO, will be probably, depending on your activity, of course, if you have thousands and P3 thousands and thousands of transactions per second, it might be some of the bigger loss, but in general, it's fairly low. But we, being conservative, we are setting these numbers like RPO 5 minutes. RTO really is controlled by the application, because what happens, the actual failover is a metadata operation. You call an API, it comes back, your secondary database becomes primary, but then you have to check your application. You want to make sure it runs. You may have to change the DNS record, et cetera. So those sort of operations take a little bit more time, which is why I said RTO really is about less than an hour. So that is kind of the set of capabilities we released. It's currently in preview. You can start testing these capabilities yourself. As I said, basically this, in case you lost the entire region, you can essentially start using the secondary database. And one important feature that I didn't mention, but it's important, the secondary is readable. So while it's being primarily used for recovery, you can also connect to it, and you can offload some of the read traffic to that secondary. The reason it's possible is because the load on the secondary is primarily, if you don't do anything else, is only based on the write traffic on the primary, because only write transactions are replicated. So there is some unutilized capacity on the secondary side. you can sort of tap into that unutilized capacity if you'd like by, for example, running some batch operations. Because if you do that on the primary, you will impact the user traffic. It might not be a good idea to combine the two workloads. But on the secondary, you have additional capacity. You can use that. Now, the size of the secondary must be the same as the primary. The reason for that is because when you fail over, the database must be capable of handling your normal workload. You don't. You can use it in the same region. For example, if you want to use that secondary just as a read-only sort of load-balancing database. For example, you have very intense analytical process that takes a lot of sort of resources, read type, but still very expensive. You can create a secondary just for that reason. We could call it load-balancing scenario. So because you can create up to four of these, you can have one secondary in a different region, and another secondary in the same region because you just want to use it for that purpose. But in general, the main purpose of it is to really create redundancy, geographic redundancy, in order to survive the major geographic disasters. So what I'd like to do now, I'd like to show you sort of the experience in the portal with some of these features. And unfortunately, I went to sleep. All right. So what I have here, I have a subscription with only one database, just for simplicity, for the demo purposes. And I'm looking at the portal, and you can see when you connect. So we have this one simple database, and it's currently located in Singapore in East Asia. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to take, and this is Premium P1. What I'd like to do, I'd like to create a redundant database, and let's go crazy and create some global, because like I said, it's totally flexible, so we can essentially replicate it anywhere we want. So I go here, and you see we have this geo-replication tab, because I've signed up to the preview. My premium database has an option of geo-replication. So here I can basically go and say, hey, I want to add a replica. And I want to choose a server. So I have three servers right now, one in Hong Kong and one in San Francisco. So I'm going to choose the San Francisco. So think about it. I'm going to replicate from Singapore to San Francisco. So this is my West US server. And I'm going to say, yeah, this is what I want. And it's going to prompt me that because it's going to cost me extra money, I say, yes, I'm willing to pay for it. So as you can see, it basically now started adding the replica. And this operation will take a little bit of time. It's a small database, and generally it depends on the size of the database. And well, it's already submitted the request, but it's going to take time for it to basically what we call seed. It's going to seed the data of the original database. In the meantime, while it's doing this, I want to jump to showing how restore works. As you can see, if I look at my list of databases, it has this tab called Deleted Databases. That essentially a list of the databases I've deleted in some past. And it shows me the entire sort of various databases I've deleted. So let's imagine I've deleted a database by mistake. And let's say this is the first one that is what I need. So if I click Restore, it shows me this dialog box. So in that dialog box, it essentially allows me to just drag this to a point in time that I need. Obviously, I cannot go before I've deleted the database, but that is sort of the earliest I can go. Like if I want to sort of get the original version of that database, I go to the beginning of it. And if I want to have something in the middle, I can change it, or I can simply type the time. If I know the precise moment, I can set it. And once I select it, I say OK, and it starts restoring that database. It chose a name for me by default with timestamp and such, but I can set any name I want. It will restore that database in the same server where you had the original database, because presumably that's where you want it, because all the security is configured there. You want to access this database immediately, et cetera. So that is sort of the restore operation. And of course, the same applies to a live database. If you've corrupted the live database, you go to restore, and you select the time in the past, and it will create a new version based on that time. So let me go back to the database and see how we're doing on that. OK, we're still, yeah, we're now done with this replica. See, now I have the replica in West US. So now I have two databases connected to each other for the purposes of redundancy. So let me go to the original database, my primary. This is very simple table which I've created for the purposes of this demo. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to change one of these columns. Let's say I'm going to change my sales forecast to higher level. Let's say very simple operation. I'm going to commit that on the primary. So it's committed on the primary. Let me go to my secondary. This is my secondary. And see what happens there. I'm going to open the Management Studio. I'm not going to, just for simplicity. Come on. Okay, so my goal here is to demonstrate that the updates happens automatically without waiting. So as you can see, 70 here as well. Let me try another change. So I go to my primary. I go back to 660. Let's see what happens here. Refresh. 60. So that commit essentially got replicated immediately, which is the point I was trying to make. If you happen to lose your database because of the disaster, the amount of data you will have lost by the time you fail over will depend on the activity on the primary. In many cases, it will be seconds or nothing, because if, for example, in the last minute or so, your primary wasn't doing any updates. So let's see how I can fail over. If I go back to my databases and go to my secondary now, again, in San Francisco, let's imagine that I need to make it now my new primary because I need to continue my business. So I go to geo replication and I'm going to call stop replica. And I'm going to stop immediately because I don't have much time. So it's going to stop. It's going to take a little bit of time while sort of all the internal metadata changes take place. But once it's happened, the database become normal database. You start committing the data changes to it. So that is essentially the failover process. Now, of course, you would like to protect that database as well, because you've just lost the region in which you were operating before. Now you can choose that database and create another replica of it elsewhere. You can choose another region and protect that database in a different region. So essentially, you have full control over where it's located, where you want it to be, and how much risk you want to take. So let's go back. Let's talk about failover patterns. So I selected three, but they're a combination of them. The most common, which we call active-passive compute with coupled failover, essentially means that the way you design your application, you have your back data tier backend of the application, let's say like in the demo case in Singapore, and you run your application tier in the same region, because presumably the proximity to the database is important for your performance. Let's say you have a chatty protocol between the application and the database. So you want to keep it that way because that's, again, like I said, it impacts your performance. So in the redundant region which you're using, in this case, for example, San Francisco, West US, you will have a standby copy of your application. And that standby copy, let's say an image of a virtual machine or web front, is essentially pre-configured to talk or to connect to the secondary. So the failover really means the failover of the application. And when it happens, let's say you're on the left-hand side, you've lost the entire region, including your application, because it's the same data center. So in that case, you will have to switch to a new instance of the app. That involves a DNS change, because the client will now talk to a new endpoint. But the proximity between the application tier and the data tier is the same, so the client experience is not going to change. So the important part of this, a DNS change, and propagation of the DNS change might take some time, let's say 15 minutes or so. And that impacts the downtime, of course. It will define the downtime of the failover. While we can switch quickly, DNS doesn't. So that's one type of failover where you kind of keep the application tier and the data tier as a unit. The second pattern I want to talk about is essentially the case where you design in such a way that the proximity to the client matters. You want to make sure that when the client is connected from the US, there is a local instance, and the client connected to from a different region, there is also a local instance. So you essentially load balance your application tier, but you use the same database. Let's say P3.1, the pattern that Tobias mentioned, the kind of the scale-up sort of first option single database. In this case, the assumption is made that, okay, if in case I've lost my database, maybe a partial failure, what happens is I fail over the database, but then all my application instances will have to know about that database change. They will have to dynamically change the SQL connection string. So that is kind of the downside of that pattern, because you need to kind of code around it. But you will still maintain the same load balancing pattern at the application tier. And it doesn't involve DNS change, because essentially the traffic is controlled by the traffic manager here. And a final pattern I want to mention is the one that makes an assumption that it is more likely that the application itself will fail before the backend fails. You observe, perhaps, or you decided that, okay, this is something that is the more likely case, in this case you will assume that the database will remain sort of active, but you will have to switch your application to a different region while connecting to the same database. So those are the patterns that we've observed working with our partners in terms of designing the application for failovers. And again, it depends, of course, on the application itself, how you deal with the database. If you're using a lot of store procs, it's one pattern. If you're using connections and execute logic in the client, it's a different one. So those are the sort of guidelines. And this is all published online today. You can go over this and read for yourself and decide which one applies to your particular case. Now let's talk about kind of filling in the blanks, as Tobias mentioned before. So if you look at the kind of the range of business continuity options across tiers, as you see, the high availability is exactly the same. We maintain the same number, because all databases is essentially protected from local events the same way. The only difference is that in the premium tier, we have more redundant replicas inside of the data center than, for example, in basic tier. But it doesn't impact the price or anything. It's just included. Point in time restore option is available in all tiers of the different retentions I mentioned. And I also said that it will be revised up for basic and standard pretty soon. As far as restoring to another region, this is not yet available. But remember I said we put the backups into the storage. The storage is geo-replicated itself, which means we always have a redundant copy of the backup elsewhere. And the other interesting development in that space was the announcement recently that now you can access your storage blobs using a secondary endpoint, readable endpoint, which is what we took dependency on, which means if I want to restore from the backup, I don't want to wait for the storage to fail over the entire thing because of the major event. I can just basically restore to a different region anytime I want, which is a great feature for applications that can sustain certain downtime because restore will take time. So you don't have to pay for it. It's included. But the downside is time. And the other downside, or I should say a trade-off, is that when you restore, we don't provide any guarantees in terms of capacity. You will essentially create a new database. So imagine the case when thousands of databases are lost and everybody is doing the same thing. Then you will run in some kind of conflicting sort of scenarios where thousands and thousands of customers are trying to restore the same database in the same region. So this is why we basically give you an option of restoring anywhere you want. But we cannot guarantee the capacity at that time. The next option is the standard replication, geo-replication, we call it. Again, this is not something available. We will have a subset of geo-replication I already explained available in the standard tier. The main limitation there is that we will not allow you to choose any region. We will tell you which region you can choose. So essentially, we will control the DR pairing. And we will also not allow you to read from the secondary. Those are the two limitations that standard geo-replication will have. But it will also cost less. And finally, active geo-replication and premium, which I already explained. And we are using this Russian doll model where the lower feature, like, for example, geo-restore, is available for all. And geo-replication is available for two, and active geo-replication is only available in premium. That's the concept.
Are you the Russian doll? Or?
Yeah, I guess so. Now, what I also want to speak a little bit about is how the kind of scenario-based value changes from tier to tier based on the features we offer. In the case of basic, only some of the business continuity scenario can be enabled because of the nature of the solution. And as you go higher from basic to premium, you will see that this kind of the scope of scenarios is increasing. For example, things like load balancing using the readable secondary is only available in premium. You can't do that in other tiers. Application relocation. You can use geo-replication to relocate your app. You can create a secondary and then terminate. And we have an option to terminate in a friendly way where you guarantee that the data will synchronize so you don't lose any data. So that is the option that only premium will have. Application failure, the case where you want to fail over because there's nothing wrong with the database tier from our side, but you have a problem in the application and you're using this coupled pattern that I explained. And you want to fail over because your application needs the failover. This is only going to be available in the premium tier. So again, the scale of scenarios changes as we go from one tier to another. Okay, well, that is what we have today. So I'd like to call to a number of actions. First of all, I really encourage you to try. It's available, it's easy to sign up, it's easy to do. And what I want to stress is we are extremely interested in the feedback. We learn as we go, and both on the performance side and the business continuity side, I'm sure we'll change things. As you tell us something doesn't work, doesn't quite make sense, or we need to tune certain parameters, et cetera, this is what we need the previews for.
Yeah. And so just some reminders on performance. Again, you can change the performance levels online, so there is no kind of downtime associated with moving from basic to P3, for example. The resources assigned are constant, so you always get the resources in your particular tier that you choose. There's not some average over time or something like that. And again, the transaction numbers that you see on the website and so on, those are the benchmark numbers. There are examples to help folks kind of self-select into a tier. They're not limits on the number of transactions you can do. And as Sasha mentioned, we are listening closely in the preview, so we're making a few changes actually right now as we speak based on customer feedback. So on the performance side, we're increasing performance quite dramatically across the tiers. And for example, here we're going in basic from one DTU to five DTUs. We're going in SO, a 5x basically improvement, depending a little bit on what your workload does, obviously, where you're limited. S1 going from 5 to 15 DTUs, so a 3x improvement. And S2, we're doubling from 25 to 50. So dramatic kind of changes in the lower end of the tiers. And then the premiums are basically the same as before. And we continue to look at this and basically evaluate things. It's important to note that the most important thing for us, other than that you're happy with the service, is this predictable performance thing, which is, you may ask, why don't you just start at like the other end of the spectrum? But it has to do with, we have to make sure that your experience is predictable and don't get back into the stochastic nature of Web and Business Edition.
All right, that's all. I'd like to, okay, questions, please.
Yeah, so this is a great question. So the question is, hey, this benchmark you have, that's all wonderful, but can I run it myself? And the answer is no, you cannot today. So we have an article out explaining kind of the, I would say, semi-detailed level of what the benchmark is. Like, what are the type of transactions, but not exactly what do they look like, what's the mix of transactions, and so on. And the reason for this is the preview. So as we go through the preview, we may basically need to change the benchmark, right? And we don't want to have then lots of different versions of the benchmark out there. And this is obviously some decision we have to make at some point, whether to make it public, but we've definitely said during the preview, it doesn't really make sense. Now, you have to remember the core reason to have the benchmark, the DTUs are the performance you get, right? Whereas the benchmark is an example to help customers kind of see, oh, okay, that seems reasonable for me, right? But hopefully that answers your question.
Yes. Okay, this is also a very good question. So because we have the backups in the storage, can you get it? Unfortunately, no, or maybe fortunately. And the reason is, there are two reasons. First of all, if you take it, we cannot take it back for security reasons, because we cannot install a backup that is not hardened and not verified into the cloud, because we might impact others. So it's just a one-way street. The second problem is the versioning differences between the SQL that we run in the cloud and what you have on-premise. So you may have a kind of difficulties installing wherever you want to install it. So really, there is not really much of a reason to give it to you in the raw form. Now, you still have the import-export service where you can create your own backup in the compatible format where you can install it anywhere you want. So this is the primary kind of way to get the database off the cloud for now. We also actually looking at the scenario where you can buy additional retention. For example, for compliance reasons, you'd like to keep it longer, let's say for a year or 5 years or what have you. We are thinking about that sort of scenarios. Can we sort of really just allow you to keep it longer for maybe extra fee of some sort, and then restore anytime you want? So that is just basically a preliminary analysis we are doing right now. Yes. Yeah, the question is, can you target a different database during the restore? Yeah, absolutely. If you restore to point in time, you can choose any database name you want for the copy that you will, again, you will be creating a new database side by side, but you will be limited to the server. Now, in the case of geo-restore, where you basically restore, you can restore to any server you want. But in that case, you cannot specify the point in time. You will get the last full backup plus daily backup. Because that's the stuff we have in the storage. We don't put all the log files in the storage because it's too much volume. It's just tremendous volume. And but that's how you can get anywhere.
And we do support changing names of databases.
Yeah, right. You can also change the names if you want. Okay.
Cool.
Yes, over there. Yes. Right. The question is, the copy that I've created in West US, in San Francisco, is it read and write or read only? The answer to that is it's read only because of the potential conflicts. If you write in both places, we will have to resolve these conflicts. Right now, the protocol allows us to do this only sort of one way, and you can read, but you cannot write, which is why I said that database has excess capacity, so you can run the batch operations, the read-only operations on it, but not like distribute your write traffic into two copies.
Okay, cool. Thank you, everyone, for staying here, and hopefully it was interesting.